Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For a lot of us, the old-fashioned lemonade stand was our only real stab at entrepreneurship, and it wasn't really a serious effort. We drank up most of the profits, and at the end of a hot summer's day, we're happy to pack it in and head to the shade, or on to the next activity. Then there's that small group of budding entrepreneurs who start with one lemonade stand and dream of a chain. They see opportunity where the rest of us see obstacles. They take risks. People like Virgin Airways' Richard Branson, or Tom Scott, co-founder of Nantucket Nectars, Kay Kaplowitz, the first female network president in television history, just to name a few. In the new documentary, Lemonade Stories, these entrepreneurs and others share the secrets of their successes and talk about the person who inspired them, their moms. Russell Simmons, co-founder of Def Jam Records, had this to say about his mother.
My mother, she told me, do whatever you want. You can be an artist, you can be an entrepreneur, you can be whatever you want to be. And that was not, my father was like, go to school.
Who knew? Behind every great entrepreneur is a mom. Tonight on Point, Lemonade Stories. How did your mother inspire your entrepreneurial spirit? How did she nurture your vocation or your dreams? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Mary Mazzio, entrepreneur, executive producer, writer, and director of Lemonade Stories. Hi, Mary. Thanks for being with us.
Gail, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm so curious, first of all. The film begins with this wonderful shot of eggs boiling in a pan, and then you see that the name of your company is 50 Eggs Films. There has to be a good story behind that.
Well, there is actually a funny story, and when I was coming up with names for my film company, and the reason I went into film was because I thought it was really important to highlight strong women in one form or another. So I was thinking, like, Medusa's Revenge. And my husband was like, if you have stationery with a woman with snakes coming out of her hair, you will never get corporate funding for what you're trying to do. So he said, you know, what's your favorite movie? And of course, it was the old Paul Newman, Cool Hand Luke. And there's a scene in there where everybody bets against him that he can't eat all 50 eggs. And Jay, my husband, said to me, he's like, that's you. You're going to go eat these eggs.
Well, you certainly got off to a good start with other films. And this one is fascinating and gave you interest, or access, rather, to people like Richard Branson. He's a high-flying entrepreneur that many people are familiar with his name. He's the founder of, as he says, All Things Virgin. And his mother, Eve, is quite a character. I want to play a clip that you have in the film in which his mother describes her own adventurous spirit.
When I was 18, I joined Cochrane's Young Lady. My parents were horrified.
Didn't take your clothes off, Mum, did you?
Wait,
you never knew you took your clothes off.
It wasn't quite striptease.
Oh, it runs in the family. I think it's great to be able to throw yourself at everything and anything in life. That certainly was my mum.
When the war first came, I went to a gliding club, which was teaching the Royal Air Force how to be pilots. I asked for a job as a pilot, but was told these jobs were only available to men. I was able to convince the instructor to permit me to glide as long as I dressed as a man. In those days, they were in single-seated gliders. And when I got up to about 300 feet, I looked down and I took fright because I realized I was a loader very high. And I released the trigger, which you're supposed to do when your nose is down, but I released mine when my nose is up. So what happens? You go into a spin. There was pandemonium, but I pulled up just in time.
The first time I did a skydive, I pulled the lever that actually got rid of the chute rather than the one that opened the chute. And it was only my sky instructor that actually came and rescued me. And there are definitely traits, I'm afraid, which I'm inheriting.
I was first.
She is clearly a character, Mary. And I was stunned in the film to learn that he regards himself as a very shy person, because you see all these incredible publicity stunts that he does, dresses up as a bride. I mean, I can't even think of some of the other wild things he's done.
Did he have to do that in response to his mom?
Well, it's funny. The apple in this case does not fall far from the tree, and he was profoundly shy. And one of the things Eve Branson said that really struck me was she said, shyness is being inverted and thinking only of yourself. Shyness will not be tolerated in the Branson household. So she set about to make sure that her child and all her children, that none of them were going to be shy. They were going to look you in the eye, they were going to shake your hand, and they were not going to hang onto mummy's, you know, skirts. And in fact, when Richard was 4 years old, she stopped about 3 miles from their home in England, and she said, okay, now you go find your way home. And, you know, she was, when he didn't turn up for 6 hours, you know, she was fairly apoplectic. And there he was, you know, just whistling and looking at the trees and looking at bugs, and cheerfully came home muddy, and, you know, and that was the beginning of his entrepreneurial path.
Well, we have one of your other entrepreneurs on the line now. Tom Scott is joining us from Washington. He is, as you certainly know, the co-founder of Nantucket Nectars. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. And
hey,
I understand that we are pulling you out of a wedding reception. So perhaps we should, after we say hello, I want to hear a little bit about your mother first from the film. I understand that she was one of your biggest cheerleaders when you were starting out. And we have a clip. It's a very poignant scene from Lemonade Stories in which you describe and she describes some of her frustrations about the lack of opportunities that women in her generation experienced.
At the time, women were expected to go to college and look for somebody and get married and have a family and children. I wondered if that's what I really wanted.
If my mom had been born at a time where it was more traditional for women to work, my guess is my mom would be involved in politics or something working towards the common good.
It was hard when I was right on the cusp of when the whole deal of women and their role in society was changing.
So, Tom, how did she influence you? Was it generally in the way that you were raised so that you were able to take some risks early on, or was it more the specific help as you got started with your business?
You know, I think it started with it's unconditional love and support. I mean, I always had it, you know, and I took it for granted. And the older you grow older, you come to recognize just how sometimes rare it is, but certainly how valuable it is. And I think that was probably the biggest thing, but also she was very much a free spirit. I mean, as you heard her say, I think she grew up at an interesting time in that she was probably just a little too old to participate in sort of the women's movement, and yet young enough to be close enough to almost taste it. And I felt it. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I think in many ways I was able to sort of live out her dreams. But always, you know, I never knew that directly. I never felt it directly. It was just a spirit that she carried that I think I got a little bit of it.
Well, I would say so. In fact, she really saw the spark of your entrepreneurial spirit early on. You know, mothers know these things. And we have another clip now in which she talks about how you got started on the road to juice greatness.
Of all my children, I think my son, Tom, is the most like me.
But I was into those things like climbing in the creek and climbing the tree and building the fort and all that.
He was a catalyst. He was a ringleader. He made it all happen.
It was during the gas crisis of 1976 that I think I became an entrepreneur.
The cars were lined up here on Brookville Road.
And we used to go car to car selling things.
Coffee and donuts and newspapers.
I never did it because I thought, hey, we can go make money. We just thought it was fun.
And was it fun, Tom?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I liked projects. I mean, it was sort of my thing. I grew up in a family. My father's a very serious athlete, and I played sports, you know, the traditional sports, but I was more into sort of the, you know, Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn kind of thing, and that's how I viewed it. This was just like a participating in an adventure and doing something that grown-ups do.
But do I also remember correctly from the film that at one point your parents really put a lot on the line to support you?
Yeah, they did. I mean, you know, relatively speaking, it wasn't probably as much as I thought it was. That's not to take anything away. They took an incredible risk for me. But yeah, I mean, it was the weight of the world as far as I was concerned, and it definitely was one of the proudest days of my life when I was able to pay my dad back and give him a little extra along the way. It was a nice thing. But that kind of support, you know, as I said, I said this to Mary, I could only go so low. They were always there for me in that kind of supportive way. And, you know, Mary, in doing this documentary, really opened my eyes to just how interesting and significant this topic is. It's not a trite thing. I think it's a powerful thing that's very real, and I was lucky to have it.
Thanks, Tom.
There's another great moment in the film, Tom, where you talk about how business schools now study what you did as if you did it on purpose, and so much of it was not on purpose.
No, no. I mean, there's – it looks genius in retrospect, but it's just
not. Because
it
worked.
Yeah. I mean, but we tried – all the things you're not supposed to do, we tried them, and we learned each of those things really the hard way. And I think that was just the whole idea along the way. Again, it was another Tom and Huck adventure of we know there's a bend coming in the river, but we have no idea what's around it. And you know, it's interesting, we were at Babson College that you know, the study of entrepreneurial, I don't even know how to say the word, entrepreneurialism is their thing. And as I say, I really think, having seen the film and followed Mary down this path, this is right there. I mean, this is right up there in terms of the X's and the O's of becoming an entrepreneur is a good relationship with those before you, and in this case, my mom.
Did you go to her specifically for business advice? I mean, did she give you ideas about how to market or what women consumers in particular, since they're probably the bigger juice buyers, did she give you specific suggestions?
No. In fact, she was as clueless as I was. I mean, I think... Yeah, it's true. I think that it was much more of a spirit thing than it was than an X's and O's thing. You know, I would go home and you know, I was, you know, call it 26, 27, 28, and my friends would have suits and, you know, company cars and expense accounts and all that kind of thing. And I'd come home in my ragtag clothes, and I wasn't making any money, wasn't going anywhere. But it was never a problem. And it was for some people. Some of my friends were also living on Nantucket and trying their own thing. They'd go home and their parents would be upset that they weren't doing bigger and better things that were far more organized. And for her, it was just no problem. You know, do your thing, have fun.
Mary, as you spoke to Tom's mom, did you get a sense of a wistfulness on her part as to what she might have done with her life if she didn't have these four children and was clearly so devoted to them?
Gail, that's a great question. And I think in many respects, there was a sense of, and not just for Jane, but really her whole generation, who and what could I have been if I had done something differently? But Tom says at the end of the segment, you know, what better and harder job is it than to raise a good kid? And so at the end of the day, I think you do have women that were not raised at a time when women were expected to work. And there's a sense of, what could I have achieved outside of the home? And I think that's true for many, many women. But at the end of the day, her contribution certainly fueled Tommy and others like him.
So let me put that one to you, Tom. Do you squirm a little bit about, you know, you were the beneficiary of all this love and devotion and attention and help from your mom?
Yeah, a little bit. I do. I mean, I think that, you know, I look at my sister, my older sister and my younger sister, but my older sister has four children as well. And she grew up in our time, in a time where she could have done whatever she wanted. And she, you know, she worked actually for the Bank of Boston when there was a Bank of Boston and had a career like that. She's as happy a mother as could be today, and I think because she had the choice and because she had the option, it was probably easier for her to say to herself, well, what exactly do I want to do? And she's chosen it and loves it and feels proud about it. I think because my mom didn't grow up at a time where that kind of spirit was alive and the choice was there, the lack of choice, I think, creates a bit of question that there might not be today, because I think that the value of what she does, and, you know, I have a child now, I just had a son, and I get it, it's really hard work, and the truth of the matter is, going off to the office is way easier than staying home. And I don't mean from a boredom perspective, I mean from a hard, hard work perspective.
You do get it, Tom. Well, thank you so much for joining us, we appreciate it.
Not at all.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, you guys.
And all the best to your mom.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about Mary Mazzio's new film, Lemonade Stories, and about how mothers have inspired some of the world's most influential entrepreneurs, about the values all mothers teach their children, and the lessons that children hold dear throughout a lifetime. How did your mother inspire you to take risks, to dream the big dreams? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Tell us about your mom. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. And on this Mother's Day weekend, we're talking this hour about the new documentary, Lemonade Stories, that showcases some very successful entrepreneurs and their secret weapons for success, their supportive mothers. Kelly Reinhardt is an 11-year-old entrepreneur, and here's how she describes her mother in the film.
My name is Kelly Reinhardt, and I founded the TPAC International when I was 8 in kids, collectibles, dolls, with my brother Adam when I turned 11. Although I don't really know what my mother was like when she was a kid, I know she used to be super shy.
Kelly didn't get her outgoing nature from me. I was always hiding behind my older sister. I made a big point when my kids were born to make sure that they always had a mind of their own. If someone asked a question, I would never step right in and give the answer for them. I made sure they had to answer for themselves.
11-year-old Kelly Reinhardt and her mother. Kelly is the founder of the Thigh Pack, and that was a scene from the documentary Lemonade Stories. And so we ask you, how did your mother help nurture your dreams? What pearls of wisdom did she pass along that have helped you dream big or start over or make it to the top? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with filmmaker Mary Mazzio. Her new documentary is Lemonade Stories. Kelly is fascinating. She started this company when she was 8 years old, and now her dad works for her. How did you find this?
Well, you know, when we started making this a year ago with Babson, it was really important that we have entrepreneurs of all different ages and races and socioeconomic and religious backgrounds, because we thought that we wanted people to identify with something in the film and someone in the film. So we found this kid entrepreneur. And I spoke with her, and she was so mature and so precocious and so fantastic. And then I talked to her dad and just thought it was just so marvelous, because he had to take a leap of faith to go work for his 8-year-old daughter.
That would give you pause.
It would give
it,
you pause.
Parent.
Yes, exactly. And there are some funny clips in the film as to what his wife Lori really thought about this, and then of course what she told, you know, her husband Bob when he said, "Yes, I am going to go work for our 8-year-old daughter." So it was just a wonderful story, and it was all about having fun. That's really the Kelly Reinhardt story. You know, it was a crazy rainy day, and Bob Reinhardt said to his kids, "You know, you're driving me crazy." And Lori said, "Sit down at a table, and whoever makes the best invention, I will go get it made." And that's, in fact, what happened. Kelly sat down, and she drew this. Her dad had been watching Bonanza reruns, and so that's how she thought of the Thigh Pack, you know, from the holsters.
I was going to say, we should explain what a thigh pack is and
yes,
how that works.
Yes, exactly. It's sort of a holster that goes on your leg that's really for keys and cell phones and MP3 players and stuff like that. And so she won the contest. And in the film, Bob actually laughs and he says, well, hers was the least expensive to produce. So, you know, his older sons had motorized skateboards and things like that. And lo and behold, she goes off and she spent all her allowance money, which was really scary for her. She's like, I really didn't want to spend that money. And she did. She sucked it up and she took a deep breath and she jumped and sold all 100 thigh packs at her middle school fair, and then bought 500 more. And then soon they had buyers asking for container loads, you know, at shows in Vegas. So it was just, you know, wonderfully serendipitous. But here's this little kid with a lot of chutzpah and verve and drive saying, hey, come look at what I've made.
How big a company is this now?
Well, I think she has sold the company, and she's now started a new company with her brother Adam. And the reason she started the company was because they fight a lot, and she wanted to get closer to him. So she's lending him some money. Isn't that just fantastic?
I'm not sure that starting a company with your brother is going to keep you from fighting, but okay.
Exactly, exactly. And so she said in the film, And God bless her, I think she'll do it. She said, I want to be a senator. I see my mom helping people. I want to help people. And yeah, maybe I'll be president.
Now, except for the Kelly story, in which we do see a dad, dads don't seem to be very present in the film. And I wonder if that's because you think that perhaps moms can have a bigger impact on their children, or simply that you wanted to make a film about moms.
That's a great question. When we were thinking about doing this about a year ago, we kept coming back to the question, what is it about, what's the common theme with all of these entrepreneurs? What is it that you're taught at such a young age, or that you watch by example? And dads are very important as well, but oftentimes they're almost always credited, certainly publicly, with achievement, with athletic success, with business success, and nobody ever says, what did mom give me other than baked cookies? Well, mom instilled, you know, maybe she didn't let you be shy, or maybe she said, be nice to your friends, you know, be nice to your employees. Or maybe she said, get up and get back on the bike and take risk. And certainly all of these women were independent and risk takers, and they clearly taught their own children to embrace risk. And almost the more important piece is they taught their children that it was okay to fail and to get back up. You know, don't stay down, get back up. And that's really hard to do. And we live in a society that doesn't permit or accept failure. And in fact, how can you learn unless you fail?
Good point. I want to go to Arthur Blank now, who is also one of the people in your film. He's joining us on the line. He's the co-founder of Home Depot and also owner of the Atlanta Falcons. Hi, Arthur. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks. It's great to be with you tonight.
Hey, Arthur. Well,
I have to say, I loved your mom, too. If I were at a dinner party in which she was in the room, I would definitely want to be seated next to her.
Yeah, she's got a lot of spunk now. I mean, she's a special person. She's been a great mother, and you've made a difference in the lives of a whole lot of people throughout our life. Thank you.
Well, I want to play everyone a clip from the film in which you introduce your mom. So let's listen into that.
My mother always stood for principle and making a difference in people's lives. All of that, I think, has been part of who I am. My name is Arthur Blank, and I'm the owner of the Atlanta Falcons, and I co-founded Home Depot with my longtime friend Bernie Marcus when I was 36 years old. I'm the second son of Molly Graf Blank, who grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
And Arthur, before we hear a little bit more of your story, I want to go to another clip. This is one that illustrates just what a gutsy lady your mom is, because you describe how she responded after your father died. And I'm interested in hearing, after the clip, a little bit about how that made an impact on you in terms of founding your company. But let's listen to that story first.
I think the most difficult challenge or obstacle my mom's had to deal with was the loss of my father. I mean, she was a very young woman.
At that point in time, it seemed like the end of everything.
This was the only man, really, that she knew.
There was hardly anything left as far as money was concerned, and I realized I had to do something or we would all end up on welfare. After a quick decision, I stepped in to run the business.
To be pushed into this family business, that had no background, and I think it was a very difficult time.
I thought, well, I'll give myself a year. I'll take a crack at it.
She kind of strapped it on, picked it up, and went from there.
You just cannot give up the first time you're knocked down. You have to have that determination and tenacity to pick yourself up and say, I'm going to try again.
Well, Arthur, that was certainly a good life lesson from your mom.
Yeah.
Did you know at the time how difficult it was for her to deal with all of this?
I don't think
you
so.
And your brother?
I was only 15 years old at the time, and I remember, you know, at that time, you know, my dad was 44 when he passed away. I didn't really realize how young 44 was. I mean, I was only 15, so 44 seemed like, you know, a long way away. And But I did appreciate the fact that she was going into this business that she really had no experience in running. But, of course, it wasn't until years later that I, you know, began my own career in business that I appreciate all the challenges that she had to deal with in terms of, you know, dealing with the folks in the business, understanding the industry, you know, understanding how to expand the business, how to make money, things which she really wasn't trained to do. But, you know, as my mom indicated, I mean, she's the kind of person that's just not going to say no. She's not going to be beaten down. She deals with with adversity, and those are lessons that I think that I've certainly learned from her and others, but really from her principally, and have certainly stood me in good stead throughout my business career and my personal life too.
And specifically, Arthur, how did that come into play when you founded your company? Were there specific things that she had said to you that resonated in terms of, okay, this is my chance to do it my way, and that's what I'm going to do?
Well, I think one of the things I learned from my mother is that you just don't give up. I mean, you just find a way to make, to make lemonade out of lemons. And I think that she was committed to doing that. And when we started our company, we lost this at Home Depot. We lost half of our startup money in the first 9 months that we were in business. And there was no way myself and my partners were thinking that this was not going to work. I mean, we were just committed, as my mother was many years ago, to making this work, to finding out what the solutions were going to be, dealing with, with customers, making adjustments in our business and our business plan, and just staying committed to it. So I think that kind of tenacity and commitment to what we were doing, I think, was very, very important, and certainly a lesson I learned from her.
And Mary, I want to ask you, as a filmmaker, when you began thinking about the people you wanted to include in this film, did you just call around till you got people like Arthur and said, you want to tell me about your mom?
Well, no, but I did. He will tell you that I was very nosy and very probative, right, Arthur?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you are.
No, I actually, again, we wanted to have very different stories, but we did a lot of research. And it became apparent that there were certain people who really, and I think there are a lot of people certainly that aren't in the film, that have a sense of principle, that have a sense of being grounded, that are generally, everyone's human, you make mistakes, nobody's a choir girl or choir boy, but everybody in the film, I think, tries to do the right thing. And I think that comes from somewhere very important, and it could be your mother, it could be a coach or a teacher, and I think that's so important. And in fact, that was one of the main themes that we were sort of looking at, in addition to this wonderful exuberance and entrepreneurial spirit.
Arthur, I have to ask, do the people at Home Depot in her home community still tremble when your mom walks through the door?
Sure, I'm sure they do. I mean, they, certainly when I ever go to a store, they enjoy seeing me, and I certainly enjoy seeing them, enjoy being with them. And I know my mother will still call me from time to time. The service, which is usually excellent, is something less than that. She'll call me, and I'll remind her, Mom, I left the company 3 years ago. I mean, here are some phone numbers to call. But, she's still very proud of our company and very much involved in caring about it.
All right. Well, Arthur, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Sure.
Take care.
Thanks, Arthur.
Okay. Thank you. Good night.
I want to hear from some of our listeners now. Let's go to Viola. I assume it's Viola, Wisconsin. Eugene?
Yes. Am I on?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
I and my two younger brothers grew up right after World War II, and we credit our success to our mother. Because anything we tried, anything we wanted to do, she let us go ahead and do it. We wrecked motorcycles, we wrecked cars, and I went through a dozen motorcycles before I finally decided to start college and put in 27 years in the classroom. But that has stayed with all three of us. She never told us we failed in all the years we were around. She let us go ahead and do it. She never put any dampers on. We used to come home dirty, scratched up, and beat up and everything else. But as a result of that, all three of us succeeded.
And have you passed on those life lessons yourself, Eugene?
I did to my son. He graduates from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, in about 3 weeks.
Well, congratulations to him, and thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
What was the common theme? I mean, I loved Eugene just saying that, Mom let us come home and get all dirty and scruffy. And, did you find that among all the mothers, or were there other characteristics that they had in common?
Each woman was so very different, but all of them were independent or had this sense of independence and had this wonderful exuberance and energy. And certainly every woman in the film had... you don't think of women as being risk takers, but in fact, I think all of these women had a wonderful risk-taking spirit, and that certainly was a common theme. In terms of temperament, there really is no common theme because everybody's so dramatically different. But and many of these women led by example, either had strength in her own opinion, but certainly, as the last caller mentioned, was very much almost on the creative side. Go ahead and explore. And Russell Simmons puts it in a wonderful way in the film. He said, you know, my mom was the creative one. She was the artist. My dad was like, go to school. So it was, you know, we find that actually a fair bit.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do want to play a clip from Russell Simmons' mom. He's the founder of Def Jam Records. He had two brothers, Danny and Joey. And this was a tough childhood for these three boys. They got into trouble. They were growing up on the streets. It was a rough neighborhood. And in one of the scenes from the film, Russell describes how important it was that his mother believed in him.
I remember it came a time when I had run out of money, and I completely destroyed whatever business opportunity I had. I remember sitting outside in the back and my mother coming out the backyard and saying, here. And she gave me money. And that money was enough to start me over again and give me opportunity. I never had to borrow again from her. And that was a tremendous push, because it was not the money. It was the investment in me. It was the belief in my future.
And keeping in mind, this was an area in which being an entrepreneur for someone like Russell was selling dope on the street.
Exactly. I mean, all three Simmons brothers are extraordinarily articulate and really smart. And talking to all of them, it was very clear to me, Russell very articulately spells out in the film what the landscape is for young African-American inner city men and what the conditions are. And he talks about entrepreneurs coming from the street and how it is that it comes to be in a very articulate way. And I think all of the brothers, certainly it was clear to me, they have a social conscience. And that was something that was drilled into them by their mother and their father as well, they were the second generation of African Americans to have gone to college. Both their parents were college educated, and that it was not a right but a privilege.
I was also fascinated by his accounting of what a strong woman she was in a time when African Americans, for example, were not allowed to go into department stores and try on clothing.
That's right.
And she didn't apparently go for that.
No. And in fact, Russell talks about, you know, Russell's extreme, as is all of his brothers, extremely politically active. And they got that from their dad in many respects. They would go and march in civil rights marches. But what they got from their mother was a sense of pride. This is who I am. And all of them said that their mother was not militant or political, but she was incredibly strong. And so she would go into department stores, and African-American women were not, or African-Americans at that time were not allowed. She said, to hell with it, I'm going in. And I think for three young boys, that's such a powerful example in terms of having confidence in who you are.
Well, and you certainly get the sense of that playing out, as you say, in terms of their willingness and desire to give back to the community.
Yeah, without a doubt. And Joe, you know, Danny Simmons, who is Russell's older brother, tells just a remarkable story about Deaf Poetry Jam. And that was originally, that aired on HBO, and that was originally intended to get kids excited, particularly inner city kids, about reading and writing and literacy. And so it's just such a wonderful initiative.
We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment after a break. We're talking this hour about how mothers nurture the entrepreneurial spirit in their children, from making lemonade on that first lemonade stand, or lending seed money for the first real business venture, or just offering words of encouragement when times get tough. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the new documentary Lemonade Stories that shows how mothers inspire and nurture the entrepreneurial spirit in their children. In the case of Billy Starr, his mother's death from cancer led him to begin a charity which has now raised more than $100 million for cancer research.
I started the PanMass Challenge because I needed to make some sense of my life, and because of the loss created when my mother died. It was a bike-a-thon, and the idea was to raise money for the Jimmy Fund and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
I supported Billy all the way. I kept saying, this is great, but I never quite saw where it was going. Everyone thought the Pan Mass Challenge in the beginning was a terrific idea, but we didn't view it as necessarily a big idea. It was a grown-up equivalent of the lemonade stands we do as kids for charity.
People closer to me were saying, you know, good for you, but grow up, get a job. And in that moment alone, whether it's my nature, or I didn't like being told what to do, I said, I'll show you. I can make this big.
Entrepreneur, Billy Starr, talking about his mother in Lemonade Stories. So we ask, how are you nurturing the dreams of your children? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Mary Mazzio. Her new documentary is Lemonade Stories. And now I want to bring into the conversation Billy Starr, founder of the Pan Mass Challenge, the world's largest bike-a-thon, which again has raised more than $100 million for cancer research. Billy, welcome. And boy, I have to think that your mother must be smiling somewhere and very proud of you.
Well, we hope so. That'd be nice.
At what point, Billy, did you realize that you had tapped into something very powerful? Because I was struck in the film by how many other sons and daughters who seem to want to use this bike-a-thon as a way of saying thank you to their moms, too, and, you know, also remembering other people that they loved and had lost to cancer.
Well, I think there were several flash points of awareness. I'd even say in 1980, the first year where absolutely everything went wrong. We ran out of food. Everybody got lost. The ferry didn't run. And in that moment when we're on the bus, when I figured people might be wanting to lynch me, they were so galvanized by the experience, by the opportunity to have done something that was clearly, at least in my perception, allowing them to give something back to their own pain, their own experiences, whatever it might be. And all of the talk was about next year. That was one pivotal moment, and I think, of course, the other that really said to me that we'd reached a tipping point was I was fortunate enough, by luck, to have gone 10 years without rain. And, of course, what would happen if it was raining at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning before they rode? Would they show up? Would they ride? In 1989, it was pouring at 4, 5, 6 in the morning. And there I woke up and was cursing and fearful. Mm-hmm. And as I went out to face whatever crowd might be there, it became pretty evident that there was very little attrition and that people had clearly said, this is a commitment. I've invested a lot in this. It's meaningful. And they show up.
What are the lessons that you pass on now from your mother?
Well, I mean, you know, I think, you know, there's a great value system in the Pan Mass Challenge. On some levels, it's very simplistic. Make a commitment. Be good for your word. Work through the pain. My kids are 6 and 3, you know, so I mean, I think they get that from me, but it probably doesn't come out delivered all that articulately. You know, I've listened to the show in between watching the Red Sox blow the game. And you know, it's just, it, you know, you struggle with your kids. But I think, of course, in my case, my mother, in my mind, she died young. I was not fully formed, but I was out of college. I was a young man. And it was, you know, it was some 10 years before I really had a sense of all that she had given me. And I think so much of it's intuitive as to what you're given. You spend the rest of your life figuring out what your parents gave you. And as an adult now, I think I get it pretty well. And I think it's in all of the segments. And Mary and Tom, everybody says it well. There's love, there's encouragement. You know, people need to be willing to fail. I mean, it's really a huge, huge fallacy. I don't know how people learn if they don't fail. I mean, you can have success after success, but how do you know how do you do until you fail? And you will fail if you put yourself out there in some capacity. But well, it's just a wrong choice of words. You know, it's just a stepping stone.
Well, Billy, we thank you for sharing your story, and congratulations again. $100 million for cancer research. Good for you.
Good for the whole group, for the PMC.
Thanks for being with us. Mary, I want to close by asking, what's the major lesson from your mother?
Oh, great question. My mother, she said, you know, Mary, you're always there when the bus comes. And I certainly, I left, I was a partner of a law firm, and I left to make movies that I had a lot to say, and I needed to say it. And my mother never said, you know, stick to the corporate track, or you should stay on Wall Street, or anything like that. And I remember I was an Olympic athlete, and I was getting cut year after year. Go home, go home, you stink. And 2 years before the Olympics, I made my first world championship team. And I remember my mother and the coach said, by the way, just know this, you will not be coming back to represent the United States in the Olympics. You stink, you're too short. I'll never win a medal with you. And I said to my mother, Mom, you got to buy your tickets. It's a year before the games. And she went, she bought her ticket. That's risk. So that's my mom.
And it's a lovely film. Where can we see it?
See tonight at 9 p.m. on CNNFN. And if you don't get CNNFN, you can go to lemonadestories.com. And many thanks to our friends at Babson and at Staples.
Well, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's just been a delight. Thank you, Gail.
And for more information on Lemonade Stories, go to onpointradio.org. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
Three bombs exploded outside a police station in a district of Athens.
This is an isolated incident which does not affect whatsoever the safety of the Olympic Liberation of the country.
He is looking now for ways to get the party leaders in the Likud to move with him toward the implementation of a peace initiative.
It is not a political channel. It will not be a democratic channel or a liberal channel or any kind of political channel.
Our fiscal prospects are, in my judgment, a significant obstacle to long-term stability.
FBI agents detained a Portland lawyer as part of the investigation into that deadly train bombing in Spain, and he's the first known arrest with connection to the March 11th bombing in Madrid.
Isn't it shameful for someone who is harassing others sexually? In the past, America was the leader of freedom, liberty, but no. Now, the new imperialism.
I told him I was sorry for the humiliation suffered by the Iraqi prisoners.
These events occurred on my watch. As Secretary of Defense, I am accountable for them, and I take full responsibility.
The campaign to win hearts and minds is over, really.
If the president doesn't fire the secretary, if he doesn't resign, I think it's the responsibility of this Congress to file articles of impeachment and force him to leave office.
If I felt I could not be effective, I'd resign in a minute. I would not resign simply because people try to make a political issue out of it.
He's an important part of my cabinet, and he'll stay in my cabinet.
It doesn't take a lot of imagination to read those descriptions and have one's stomach just turn in disgust. The focus on the pictures being released is, with all due respect, missing the point.
Secretary Rumsfeld, in all due respect, you've got to answer this question, and it could be satisfied with a phone call. This is a pretty simple, straightforward question. Who was in charge of the interrogations? What agencies or private contractors were in charge of the interrogations? Did they have authority over the guards? And what were the instructions to the guards? This goes to the heart of this matter.
It does indeed.
Among the events of this past week, Athens is rocked by three bombings just 100 days before the Greek capital is set to host the Olympic Games. Israel's ruling Likud party rejects Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's Gaza withdrawal plan. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan says huge budget deficits threaten America's long-term economic stability. The Fed did not raise interest rates this week, but is expected to do so soon. Former Vice President Al Gore buys a television network aimed, he says, at young people. Portland, Oregon lawyer Brandon Mayfield is arrested in connection with the March 11th Madrid bombings. In response to Middle East anger at images of abuse at Abu Ghraib prison, President Bush gives interviews to two Arabic-language satellite networks, the U.S.-funded Al-Hura and the Dubai-based Al-Arabiya. Calls ring out for Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to resign, and Rumsfeld, General Richard Myers, and others testify today in front of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees. So, Jack Beatty, what do you make of all of this, particularly Rumsfeld's testimony and what the larger story says about us as Americans?
Well, it doesn't say anything good, although Rumsfeld tried to make it sound as if our ability to investigate ourselves was a great plus. He said, well, we do this sort of thing. Al-Qaeda doesn't. It's sort of using a strange baseline to compare us to these murderers. But, you know, the senators kept saying, what's true, this doesn't reflect our values. But it does reflect some things about us. One, it reflects the moral paradox of this war, these tortures do. We are daily killing the people we went there to save. Something like 10,000 civilians have been killed in this war. And, you know, some by impersonal technological violence. I think of the family in Hilla. I think it was a family of 14 who were perforated to death by our cluster munitions. I think of, and some of it has been just wanton, almost murder. I think of the story in the New York Times of a 71-year-old man who got out of a car with a cane, was confused, he walked in the direction he shouldn't, and he was shot dead by our soldiers. That's the reality. It also reflects our history, and this was brought home to me poignantly when a comment from a man in Saudi Arabia, Princeton graduate, who said that the photograph of the prisoner with the hood over his head and strung up that way, reminded him of nothing more than the Ku Klux Klan. And, of course, the Ku Klux Klan, I've just been reading a history of Reconstruction, did this again and again, the sexual poses, the, you know, arraying people so that they're touching each other and so on. This was part of their terrorism. And so here these young Americans just go right back to the classic poses of American racism. And, of course, the fact that this is a dusky people in a foreign land, that it just adds that charge to it. And the president said something really extraordinary. George Will got a lot of comment about it. This is what the president said last week. He said, there are a lot of people in the world who don't believe that people whose skin color may not be the same as ours can be free and self-govern. I reject that. I believe that people who practice the Muslim faith can self-govern. I believe that people whose skins aren't necessarily are a different color than white can self-govern. It's as if the president is assuming that we are a white people rather than the multiracial democracy we are. That's the same kind of, that's on the continuum of race thinking, I think, that is involved in this horrible Pearl Harbor of a public relations and moral disaster.
Well, a moral story, certainly, and a political one, too. I was interested to see this afternoon there's a new Washington Post ABC News poll that says a large majority of Americans believe that Donald Rumsfeld should not resign over the Iraq prison scandal. Something like 7 in 10 Americans said that he shouldn't be forced to quit.
Gee, I'm really surprised at that. I don't know what to say. I mean, unless they think there's what could be worse? But I suppose they just don't see any connection between him and the events. They don't quite understand, it seems to me, the political nature of this. We need to make a gesture.
Well, and also more pictures, more videos to come. So clearly not a story that's done yet.
No, the mirror of this is going to go on for a while.
Well, Jack, thank you so much. Hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Stanley Chang. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.